Hello, and welcome to the All 80s Movies Podcast, the podcast where we talk about the blockbusters, the flops, and everything in between from one of the freshest decades for movies, the 1980s. I'm host Bill Banton. Along with me on this journey, revisiting 80s movies, is my co-host Jason Masick. Hello, Jason.
I'm going to pull the chain on you, pal. And you want to know why? Because you're fucking up my city. Because you're walking all over people like you own them. And you want to know the worst part? You're from out of state.
That's right, listeners. We are discussing, with spoilers aplenty, the 1981 crime drama Sharky's Machine, produced by Orion Pictures and Deliverance Productions, and distributed by Warner Brothers. It stars Burt Reynolds and Rachel Ward. Directed by Burt Reynolds, this movie is rated R with a running time of 2 hours and 2 minutes. It is based on the 1978 novel of the same name, written by William Deal. So, what is this movie about? What's on the box? If you grew up in the 1980s and went to your local video store to rent this movie, you would find this description on the back of the VHS box. It is What's on the Box. Take it away, Jason.
Some cops are good at opening a case. Sharky knows how to finish one. Burt Reynolds' longtime pal couldn't make up his mind. Should he venture into comedy? Seeking another opinion, Clint Eastwood sent the script for Every Which Way But Loose to Reynolds, who, for nearly a decade, had worked in nothing but comedies. Clint, joked Reynolds, you're getting into my territory, and if it's a success, I'm gonna go out and make Dirty Harry Goes to Atlanta. When the Georgia-born actor began Sharky's Machine, Eastwood sent a telegram saying, you really weren't kidding, were you? In Sharky's Machine, Reynolds proved he knew how to work those celluloid mean streets, starring in and directing a film that is unexpectedly accomplished cop thriller. A tough, loud, bloody movie, and an enveloping one too, says Janet Maslin, the New York Times. He plays Tom Sharky, an Atlanta cop whose gung-ho explosiveness on a narcotics case gets him demoted to the vice squad cesspool. There, he can routinely bust pimps and whores, or turn his colorful crew into a machine geared for bigger prey. Portraying vital cogs in Sharky's Machine are Brian Keith, Charles Durning, Bernie Casey, Richard Libertini, and John Fieldler. And lovely Rachel Ward is the $1,000-a-night call girl who sets Sharky's personal and professional lives spinning. It's easy to get attached to the likable characters played by these top-notch pros, but be advised. In the bullet-for-bullet world of Sharky's Machine, newly issued in hi-fi stereo, even the good die fast. Sharky's Machine.
Sharky's Machine. Jason, how are we doing?
I'm doing better now that I got through that What's on the Box. There were a lot of words in that one.
Yeah, there's some almost stellar whole facts and trivia there in the beginning.
Yeah, no kidding. How about that? You ready to discuss this Burt Reynolds classic from 81?
Let's do it. Jason, what's your earliest memory of Sharky's Machine?
Well, my earliest memory, Bill Bant, would have to start with Burt Reynolds, and it kind of ends there because I'm not sure I had seen this film, and after watching it for this very podcast, that pretty much confirmed it. I have never seen this movie, or at least not all the way through. Maybe a bit or piece here or there, but I did watch the trailer, and I figured out that if I have a memory, it most likely derives from that trailer. Spoiler alert, it has to do with glass shattering and someone falling out of a building. Anyway, I always liked Burt Reynolds as a kid. He was super charming, very funny and appealing in the Smokey and the Bandit series and the Cannonball Run film franchise. And later on, I would even know him a little from his appearances on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And I would recommend watching those clips on YouTube. I knew of the film Deliverance and would eventually see that film many times much later, starting in college, I believe. And obviously now I am a big fan of Boogie Nights. Obviously that came out much later on. And he, of course, was nominated for Best Supporting Actor for that film. So I'm a fan of his work, his comedy, his lighter films, and his heavier films. So I just had that vague, weird memory from the film's trailer, from the Sharky's Machine trailer, and was like, okay, I can't wait to check out this gritty cop drama. So that's all I got, Bill Bant. What are your earliest memories of Sharky's Machine?
Yeah, I think the first time I heard about this movie was, so back in the day on HBO, when they were in between movies, they would show behind the scenes for upcoming films. And I'm pretty sure they did a behind the scenes of Sharky's Machine, because the big thing about this movie is that, spoiler alert, that jump, that end scene.
Yep.
The 220-foot drop, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get into that a little bit in facts and trivia. And we have mentioned our notorious stuntman, Dar Robinson,
right,
before. Yeah, I think that was the first time I heard about the movie, was because of that. And like you, I was a big Burt Reynolds fan, because growing up, for me, Burt Reynolds was either Smokey and the Bandit or Cannonball Run. So it was all these silly car chase kind of comedies. And I had never really seen him in anything serious. Probably the first movie would be, as you mentioned, Deliverance. It was probably his best movie. So going back and watching this, though, because I've only seen it once before, and I really didn't remember anything going into it. And then things were slowly coming back to me a little bit. Like, I knew this, you know, the big stunt was going to happen. I remembered him losing his fingers, and that was really it. This is almost like watching it again for the first time. So it was kind of good to go back and watch it and see what I think about it all these years later.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I was excited to see this. I'll be honest. And just before we came online to start recording, I actually showed Bill Bandt that I had bought a used copy of the DVD at a great store in Tarzana here in the LA area. And from the little research I had done on it, because I didn't want anything spoiled for me, it seemed as though it was a popular film back in the day. And this is my kind of genre. I was all about it. Are we ready to get into those initial thoughts?
Yeah, go for it. Yeah, first time watching it, Jason. What'd you think?
What did I think, Bill Bandt? I will start with our star and director, Burt Reynolds, who stars as Sergeant Tom Sharkey. This is his third directorial effort after Gator and The End. He goes all the way back to the early 60s. Lots of TV series, westerns, cop series, and wartime series. But I'll skip ahead to the 70s, brief snapshot. And first off, what could be his breakout role? I guess breakout dramatic role, at least, in Deliverance. And then he is also in The Longest Yard and Gator and Smoking the Bandit and Hooper, Starting Over. Also, the name of the movie was Starting Over. And then going into his 80s snapshot, of course, Smoking the Bandit 2, The Cannonball Run, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, Smoking the Bandit Part 3, where he's credited as the real bandit in that one, not just the bandit. He does Cannonball Run 2, a movie called Heat. No, not that Heat, different Heat. He's also in the film Malone. I haven't seen that one in some time, if at all. He was in Rent-A-Cop, Switching Channels. And then on to the 90s, I just have to mention this one. He was in the film Cop and a Half. Now, I'm mad at this movie, Bill Bandt. You want to know why?
Yes.
Because of the trailer. That trailer came out, I believe, when we were just in college. And what music is playing at the very beginning of the trailer, even before the first shot appears on the screen? None other than the Miami Vice theme. And when I heard it, I was like, oh my God, this is it. It's going to be a Miami Vice movie. They've made a movie, because this is just post the series ending in 89, and now it's the early 90s. No, it was the trailer for Cop and a Half. Other notables are Striptease in 96, and of course, he has a bit of a renaissance with Boogie Nights. And after that, goes on to do a bunch of movie and TV appearances until his passing at age 82, just a handful of years ago in 2018. Moving on to our starlet, Rachel Ward, the beautiful Rachel Ward. She's known for The Thornbirds, this, of course, Against All Odds, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, Fortress, all in the 80s. And she worked steadily in film through the 90s in many B-movies and TV movies, and was still working as recently as 2022. She's been married to actor Brian Brown since 1983. And a little tidbit regarding Sharky's Machine. In 1981, she did receive a Golden Globe Award nomination for New Star of the Year for her role in Sharky's Machine. Okay, into my real initial thoughts. I like this movie a lot. I liked it a lot, man. It's far from perfect. But like I said, this is my kind of movie. I like the gritty cop dramas. The cops working the beat or the stakeout and the street level feel, i.e. Nighthawks. Some of these movies from the early 80s really have that 70s hangover feel, and I mean hangover. They're weird. A little blend of the old and the new. I said that about Brainstorm. I saw it in Private Benjamin, or when we did For Your Eyes Only. And of course, it's understandable. It's the transition into the 80s. But it does come off as one of those fever dream movies for me. So I'm deciding whether or not to categorize this as like a hangover movie, meaning like the day after, you know, drinking too much, or the fever dream movie. I can't decide. Burt Reynolds is a pretty cool customer in this. He's got that natural charm about him, and sure, he's handsome. But there's an everyman quality here in this portrayal as Sergeant Tom Sharkey, and there are very specifically designed scenes which give him a chance to show his vulnerability, which I thought was great. This is not the Smokey and the Bandit, Burt, or Cannonball Run, Burt. This is tough veteran cop, Burt. I liked it. Rachel Ward. My goodness. She's gorgeous, man. And I thought she was pretty darn good in this, Bill Bant. Very alluring. She's got a wonderful stare. It's kind of like this sensual glare almost that's quite piercing. She has this great and speaking voice. It's a bit lower with that touch of rasp. And she has a little accent put on top of it. She's got her British background, of course. And then moving on to our baddie, our antagonist in this, Henry Silva. My God, man. He just adds to the wonderful weirdness of this. He's an excellent bad guy in this. He plays crazed extremely well. He surprised me in this with his unpredictable yells and screams and his just weird actions in general. Speaking of which, this movie is really violent and it's pretty graphic. I don't know if I was prepared for how graphic it was. It does not hold back. Spoiler alert, we've got guns to the head, shotgun to the face, hit and runs, pummeled to death, cutting fingers off. It's that kind of violent. And spoiler alert, good guys die. Here's an initial thought, Bill Bant. I wasn't quite sure about the editing in this film. It was a little confusing at times as to who was who in the beginning for me. And this is my little just kind of background and introduction for our listeners into the world of this movie. But we're introduced to Sergeant Sharkey, who works in the narcotics department, and his fellow officer, Smiley, and what I believe is supposed to be his partner, Jojo. Joe Tips, Detective Joe Tips. And then after a drug sting gone wrong in which a chase ensues and an innocent civilian gets killed, Sharkey gets bounced down to the vice department, which is literally in the basement of the police headquarters. And now we're introduced to Detective Papa, played by the great Brian Keith, and Detective Arch, played by the great Bernie Casey, and their lieutenant Frisco, played by the great Charles Durning. But then we're also shortly thereafter introduced to Sharkey's longtime friend and fellow cop that works in the personnel department, Nosh, played by the great Richard Libertini. If that weren't enough, we then get into the plot, which involves wiretapping a prostitute ring led by the main baddie, Victor, who we learn is a real bad dude involved in sex trafficking and grooming young girls to become prostitutes, and is making his play to take over Atlanta. And who's on Victor's payroll? None other than the soon-to-be governor-elect Hotchkins. But we do not want to forget Victor's main henchman, whom I mentioned, Henry Silva, who portrays the character Carlos Scarelli, or Bill Scarelli, or Bill Score, or William Score. He goes by several names in this. And then we're also introduced to our surprise Asian henchmen known as the Chins, who appear literally out of nowhere to use their martial arts and weapons to beat people to death. It's a lot. That's my point. And it's wild, and it's dark, and it's violent. And again, there's some editing in the beginning that's just a bit disorienting and makes you ask, well, wait, who's that guy? And who are all these people? And where are we now? And why is Henry Silva killing prostitutes? And there's a lot of sultry, weird 70s music that adds to the weirdness. And so it was a bit convoluted in the beginning. I couldn't figure out how to turn on the subtitles on my used DVD. So that didn't help at all. So anyway, there's some awkward exchanges. Again, some played for humor. I know this sounds like I'm cutting to my complaints already, but just my initial thoughts. Not all the comic relief worked for me in this. The writing's sometimes clunky or trying a little too hard, but then it'll work completely in another moment. This leads me to this initial thought that it was like a push and pull for me throughout this film, Bill Bant. And again, I'm going to remind everybody that I really like this movie. It's just, I do have some criticisms. It's like this. Lieutenant Frisco, played by Charles Durning. He was just an awkward comic relief character for me. And his partner, Detective Jojo, is yelling all the time. And then you get Papa and Arch having a weird exchange about the American diet versus Japanese food, and it doesn't make really much sense. And it makes the long stakeout scene even longer. But then I actually really liked the love story aspect that really pulled me in. I liked the chemistry between Rachel Ward and Burt Reynolds. Lines like, "You're a strange man." And I was like, yeah, well, this is a strange movie. But Reynolds has some really good lines. Like when he says to Smiley in the beginning, after Smiley says, "I'm sorry I screwed up, what can I do?" And he says, "Have a heart attack." Love that line. But then we get Henry Silva, who's extremely menacing through the whole movie. And at the very end, has this weird relationship scene with his brother, Victor. And that gets super weird and feels kind of unearned. And I was like, okay, that takes me out of it. And then it gets me right back into it in the final sequence. So push, pull, push, pull. I'm in and out, in and out. I'm going to say this much. There's a bait and switch in this movie, which I actually absolutely loved. And I'm not going to spoil it here. I'm going to get into it in our favorite scenes. I just didn't see it coming. It got me. I was lulled into it. It's the whole funny Valentine stakeout montage that like leads into it. It reeled me in and I totally took the bait. So I'll just say this, well played, Sharky's Machine, well played. You know what? My standout performance in this, which was Richard Libertini as Nosh. I just really liked Richard Libertini in this. He cracks me up. Of course, I can only see him in Fletch, but he's great. He plays the role of Nosh. Again, I mentioned he was in the personnel department here in the Atlanta PD, but becomes a major part of Sharky's Machine. And he's a longtime friend of Sergeant Sharky. Let me end my initial thoughts by saying that the movie really appealed to me overall. I like the feel. I just like this genre, the relationship between Sharky and Domino. Domino is the high-priced call girl that Rachel Ward portrays. And there were some surprises for me, a little bit of twist here and there. And the bad guys were actually bad. Bill Bant, do you remember when there were good villains in movies? You remember that?
Yes.
Yeah, it's kind of refreshing. And it felt like there were real stakes in this and that there was actual real danger in this. So I found it gripping. That's it. Those are my initial thoughts. What are yours, Bill Bant?
Yeah, for me, my initial thoughts, of course, yes, we have our gritty cop trauma, which gritty. You and I both love. And I was thinking, if I was back at UM and I was programming our film series for Friday nights, I'm taking this and I'm putting it with Nighthawks. So we have our gritty cop drama with a major 80s movie star, Sylvester Stallone and Burt Reynolds. And it really was interesting to see Burt Reynolds in this kind of role. I totally forgot that he had directed that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big surprise. And being his third movie, I'm almost going to steal what you said with the push and pull, because I felt the same way about this. There were some scenes I thought he did really great with the directing, and there was other scenes that totally took me out of it just because mm-hmm. I just felt like it wasn't directed well or the scenes were... I'll get into complaints.
Agreed.
I thought overall, yeah, he did a pretty good job with it. I thought it was funny because you and I being such big Miami Vice fans, whereas this movie, Vice is not where you want to be. It's literally in the basement of this police department. And then 3 years later, we'd have one of the biggest cop shows on television about Vice cops.
Right.
So I found that pretty humorous. Yeah, Rachel Ward for her first film. Yeah, I thought she did a great job. Yeah, she really worked as Domino, the $1,000 a night call girl, which I was trying to calculate in my head. I'm like, oh my God, how much would that be now? Just the cast in this, man, this is like the who's who of character actors. And then I was trying to figure out all their ages. I'm like, this is one of the oldest departments ever, too. I think the average age of that Vice department is older than us.
They certainly look older. It's a great point.
That still works. And I thought it was kind of funny with some of their back and forth. And I did think the stakeout stuff went too long, but when I went back and watched it, like when you break it down into sections, I was like, oh, this is a pretty cool conversation between Nosh and Sharky. Oh, this is a pretty cool conversation between Arch and Papa. But when you string it all together, like, oh, this is a little too long. Get into the action. You could have cut about 10 minutes out, I think. This is mm-hmm. one you could have been a little bit shorter. But overall, I thought it was good. I probably didn't like it as much as you did. I wasn't that big on the Sharky Domino relationship.
Hmm.
When you think about this movie, this is almost like a dramatic stakeout, the Richard Dreyfuss movie.
Right.
Cop staking out a woman, ends up falling for her. Comedy ensues in stakeout in this one, drama and big time shootouts occur. It was funny that you mentioned the violence, because I think for us now, watching it, it didn't seem as big of a deal. But I was actually watching a documentary about this movie, And people were coming out of the theater saying they couldn't believe how violent it was.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that would make sense because this is really a big turn. He hasn't done a movie like this in a while. And yes, some of the violence is pretty graphic, but I think I'm just immune to it at this point. You know, when you watch RoboCop,
sure,
compared to this, it's nothing. But yeah, probably watching it back in 1981, you're like, holy crap. I mean, you see someone literally get shot in the chest. There's another scene that, you know, we'll save that for you to talk about later. And then even the end gunfight, there's our Billy Score and Archer having a gunfight where they're 6 feet from each other and it's just blood everywhere.
Yeah.
So I didn't think about the violence until you mentioned it. And then when I saw in the documentary, it's like, oh, okay. So yeah, it is certainly a gritty cop drama. I like the fact it took place in Atlanta, just to be somewhere different. Not New York, not Chicago. That was cool too. And I'll get into my favorite scenes. There's a ton of aerial shots of the city, and mm-hmm. I thought they really worked well for me. So that's my overall thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree, especially, you know, when it comes to that violence, you were spot on, because it's not as if I was watching it and I was finding the violence stomach churning or that it...
No, not at all.
Yeah, it's just that, oh, wow, for an early 80s movie, this is pretty in your face and it's not holding back at all. And I also agree, not only with the editing that I commented on and a little bit of the writing, the screenplay, but yeah, I agree that some of the direction, it's uneven. There's just some unevenness to this tonally. In my opinion, I would have taken out 10 minutes as well. I would have taken out some of the comic relief aspects of it, but I agree. There's a couple of scenes in that stakeout where you watch it and I'm like, oh, I understand what they're trying to do here, but it doesn't serve the story. It's just filler. If you're just going to have it in as filler to establish a place or to establish that the cops have to be there while Sharky's taking a shower because he can't be on the surveillance 24/7. He's got to go to the bathroom at some point. That's fine. But the banter must be more interesting then, or funnier. It better be a funnier story. So anyway, yeah, I think in general, yeah, I pretty much agree outside of the relationship aspect, which I actually did like a lot. But are you ready to get into some favorite scenes and moments from Sharky's Machine?
Yeah, let's do that. And yeah, I guess I got the first one.
Yeah,
and
start us off.
It is the opening credits into our opening scene of the film. Film opens, helicopter shot of downtown Atlanta, and we're flying through and they're flashing up the credits. And I like they did all the names of the actors and neon writing, this red neon writing. And playing their opening song, which is called Street Life. And we zoom in down to some railroad tracks. And walking along the railroad tracks is Tom Sharkey, played by Burt Reynolds. And he's walking along the tracks. And we see that he's holding a satchel with him. And he's going through the rougher part of Atlanta. Looks like some old warehouses, some old buildings that are not being in use anymore. We find out that Sharky is meeting up a buyer on a narcotics deal, and he ends up inside this abandoned warehouse, and our bad guy pulls up in his car and they have a little exchange. And of course he asks Sharky to flash the money, and Sharky flashes his money with his gun on the top and lets him know that that gun is ready to use at any time. And our dealer doesn't seem to be too impressed with Sharky's gun, but he takes him over to the narcotics, which I believe was heroin. Do they really mention what it is?
They don't. It's hard to tell what all the drugs are in this film. Sometimes they're explained, sometimes they're not. In this particular sequence, it looks like white powder in the bag. I thought it was cocaine, but it could have been anything. It could have been heroin, sure. But it was a whitish powdery substance in a little baggie.
Yeah, I didn't think it was cocaine just because of my advice, because you usually get those big kilo bags. And this is almost just like a sandwich bag full of stuff. It's not a lot.
It's pretty meager.
So they're doing the exchange, and all of a sudden we see a car pull into the warehouse. And the dealer gets a little skittish, and Sharky's trying to calm him down. He's like, hey, he's probably just lost. He's going to turn around. And the dealer's like, you better turn around or I'm going to blow you away. And at that point, Sharky's getting a little nervous too, because he honestly doesn't know what this car is and what this car is doing here. And he could accidentally get killed because of this car. And the car stops and a head pops out. And he recognizes Sharky and lets him know that he knows who Sharky is. and basically blows Sharky's cover. And at this point, the drug dealer's about to blow Sharky away, but luckily his gun jams, so that gives Sharky enough time to duck for cover. And while he's getting shot at, the dealer shoots at Sharky, runs, turns to the car, and shoots at that also, missing the driver that we find out is Smiley, who's also a officer in the same precinct, and he takes off. And now we have a foot chase with Sharky and the dealer, and Sharky tells Smiley, yeah, nice job, asshole, call backup to block off the alleyway so we can stop this guy. I actually like the music they were using during this.
Totally agree. Doc Severinsen did the score.
Oh, okay. And so he's giving chase down the alley, and then the police pull up to block up the alley. But this dealer has a gun that would almost put Dirty Harry to shame and basically blows up a car with his gun, which distracts the officers that are trying to block off the alleyway. And then he takes off down a very busy street, grabs a hostage, a poor woman who is pregnant, and then starts to drag her towards a bus. And at this moment, Sharky comes around, meets with his partner, Jojo, and another police officer. This is a really cool scene because everybody's kind of talking over each other because Jojo's complaining about what the hell was Smiley doing there. And Sharky's trying to tell the cop to get the SWAT there right away and that Sharky's going to go out and try to stop this guy. And all this, like three of them are talking at the same time and it's just hectic.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what that moment is. That was really cool. So then Sharky runs out into the street to track down the drug dealer. And at this point, he's stopped the bus, the MARTA bus, so public transportation bus, gets the bus driver to open and he gets in the bus. And at that point, Sharky is giving chase to the bus. He gets shot at a couple of times before the drug dealer gets on the bus. And now the drug dealer's on the bus, got everybody in the bus hostage because it's about 3/4 of the way full. And now Sharky's sprinting after the bus, reaches it on the driver's side, flashes his badge, and basically tells him to stop the bus. And when the bus driver does this, the drug dealer is very pissed and shoots the driver, mortally wounding him, but he opens the door in time for Sharky to get in. So Sharky jumps on the bus, checks the driver, sees the driver still alive, but you can tell by the look of the driver's face that he's in deep doo-doo. So Sharky decides he's going to try to talk the drug dealer into giving up the hostage, but the drug dealer's response is shooting at Sharky, pierces the metal plate right above Sharky's head, and Sharky realizes there's no negotiation with this guy. He's got to find a way to stop him and stop him fast. So when he's looking at the dealer, he notices that the drug dealer's leg is exposed because he's trying to hide behind the woman. So he shoots the drug dealer in the leg. The drug dealer starts randomly shooting in the bus, hitting a passenger, but he lets go of the woman, and then Sharky blows the drug dealer away, and he falls up against the back doors of the bus, and then Sharky opens the door, having the drug dealer fall into the street, and then the cops surround him, and end of scene.
Great stuff, man. So many little moments that make this opening chase sequence kick ass. I also had this as my first favorite scene. I'd like to point out a few things as well, or just maybe just go over the same points you made with my perspective here. I love that opening shot of that helicopter aerial photography sweeping over the downtown Atlanta skyline. It seems to be somewhat maybe late afternoon. The lighting's great. We get that opening image of what is the Westin Peachtree Plaza skyscraper. And we hear this orchestrated version of that song Bill Bant mentioned, Street Life, which is great. The original is the full like disco jazzy version, but this version starts off pretty sultry, which sets the tone and the mood that I absolutely love. And then the actual song kicks in, and that stuff I can't stand. I'll be honest with you. The 70s disco jazzy stuff does not work for me. It works in the way that Doc Severinsen uses it in the score for certain action sequences, but I just have some sort of adversity, is that a word, to 70s music. It's just a taste thing for me. Anyway, it does set the mood in the beginning. And you know what it reminded me of immediately is later on in the 80s, we get Someone to Watch Over Me, the Ridley Scott film, and the opening sequence, an aerial shot of the New York City skyline at night, and we hear that sultry song in the beginning, Someone to Watch Over Me, sung by Sting, and it just sets that mood, and I'm all set to go. So I love the fact that this our drug dealer in this opening chase, his name is Highball Mary. That's his credited name. And then when they get him at the end and he falls out of the bus dead, they call him Junkman. He's the Junkman. So many names in this. You're just like, what? Who is that character again? I love that moment when Detective Smiley pulls up in his car to basically ruin this whole drug bust, this undercover drug sting. And he just yells out of the window, hey, Sharky, you all right? It's me, Smiley. It's like, yeah. Wow. Hey, asshole, shut your frickin' mouth. But yeah, this shootout is great. By the way, to step on some trivia, that gun that Highball Mary is using happens to be very similar to the Magnum pistol that Dirty Harry uses. So there's a reason why you make that comparison, Bill Bant. And the gunshots in this are wonderful. They're really loud all throughout the movie. Yeah. Even when our villain, Henry Silva's Bill Score, is using a suppressor on his pistol, they don't even give that silencer sound. They just use the full gun sound effect. It's great. They don't care. We like gun sounds in this movie. That's what they decided. So great chase. There's a moment when Sharky is chasing Highball Mary, which is straight out of, all I could think of is the parody trailer from The Big Chill of JT Lancer. Because there's a moment when Sharky jumps over a fence and does like a front somersault and lands on his feet. I'm like, oh my God, that's from like a 70s TV show trailer. It's brilliant.
I loved it.
It's wonderful. I'm like, oh, wow. Well, that establishes, yeah, he's our hero. It's a hero shot and a hero somersault and he's in shape. He's ready to go. So all that's great. That moment when Highball Mary, yeah, shoots the hood off of JoJo's detective vehicle and just like explodes is wonderful. And then, yeah, at the very end when he falls out of the bus dead, that being Highball Mary and the cops like, oh, is that the junk man? I think, what does he say? Sharky says, yeah. And the cop is like, is he dead? And Sharky goes, why don't you shake him and see if he comes around? It's just like, yeah, man. So yeah, I agree, Bill Bant. Good call on this. Street level action, fast paced, intense. You can feel it. It's Burt Reynolds running, cops yelling. It's lines like, everybody stay down. It's the gunfire and Sharky dive rolling across the street, avoiding the bullets. It's that pumping 70s score by Doc Severinsen. It's everything I want. So good call, man.
All right. What do you got for our next favorite scene from this?
Absolutely, man. I'm going into the romantic stakeout sequence. So this is a little bit of a blend. I'm cheating here and putting a couple scenes together, but I'm going to start with this stakeout sequence. So to get our audience caught up here, Sharky's machine has been assembled. This machine is composed of detectives Papa, Arch, and Nosh, and sometimes Lieutenant Frisco, and also these goofy medical examiners, this metal examiner right. duo. I don't know about those guys. They're tasked with staking out this apartment complex, which houses the high-priced call girl, Domino, the beautiful Domino, played by Rachel Ward. And her number one client happens to be this popular politician who is running for governor named Hotchkins. So Sharky and his pal from the personnel department, Nosh, break into Domino's apartment dressed as electricians and they install wiretaps. And when Domino suddenly comes home early, they go into the lobby. They rush out into the lobby pretending to be working on the elevator. When Domino exits that elevator and Sharky gets a good look at her, she turns around, gives him a long smile back, and he can clearly see she's an absolute stunner. Cut to Sharky and the guys are staked out across the way from her apartment in another building inside an abandoned room or apartment of some sort. It's all set up with their recording equipment and they're watching her with their surveillance equipment like binoculars and cameras. And you see that the reel-to-reel recording equipment with the tape running through it. And they're recording all these conversations which are being picked up by the wiretaps in Domino's apartment. We get a little funny conversation between Sharky and Nosh about a girl they both dated in high school. And then Sharky ends up leaving the room to go tail Domino as she goes to a dance class. And she's dancing and she's looking beautiful and wonderful. And Sharky's looking on fondly from a distance. Sharky's pulling these 24-hour shifts here, all-nighters, overnighters, staking out Domino's apartment from across the way and ostensibly living with Domino at this point, but obviously at a distance. He's always watching her talk to her best friend Tiffany, watching her sleep and listening to her snore, watching her play the piano. Sharky's up at all hours, smoking, eating junk food, sleeping on a cot in this empty room, but he's clearly becoming more involved with Domino the more he watches her every move. It's a montage of Sharky basically falling in love with Domino from afar. We even see Sharky going to bed at the same time as her, eating at the same times and drinking alcohol at the same times. All the while, we see this recording equipment behind him that's rolling because it's constantly recording her and her conversations on the phone or her talking to herself or Tiffany. Anyway, we get the sultry orchestrated version of My Funny Valentine in the background, which then blends into Domino actually singing the song, which, of course, Sharky can hear over the recordings and the wiretaps. And he sings along with her from afar. And then he says goodnight. And across the way, we see her turn off her bedside lamp. And that's where that kind of romantic montage of the stakeout concludes. And I really appreciated that whole sequence. It works. I was like, okay, it's clear that Sharky is falling for this woman from a distance. And I get it. He's doing this job. He's spending so much time paying attention to her every move that he's really getting to know this woman. We get some in-between conversations and more stakeout stuff that is just kind of bland conversation. But basically, this is where I'm now blending into my next favorite scene, if you will allow me, Bill Bant, which is what I'm calling Domino's death. Or is it? We know this from the stakeout that Domino has had a guest, and this is her number one client, the soon-to-be governor or governor-elect Hotchkins. And Hotchkins is this older gentleman who clearly is in a position of power, and he's fallen in love with her and has promised her a house. He's actually bought a house for her. The sale is done. He's bought the house, or I should say the purchase is done. And I don't know if she's in love with him, but she loves the idea of escaping this life of prostitution and being a call girl. And she wants to become a dancer, and she wants to live this life with Hotchkins, this fantasy life in this house, her own house. And then after that, we get a scene between Domino and the evil Victor, whom we soon learn is pulling all the strings, pulling everybody's strings. He's the puppet master, and he wants to take over Atlanta. He's like the evil mob boss that's running this prostitution ring and grooming these young girls. And he goes to see Domino, and Domino says, I want out of this life. This is my last night. And he says, okay, this is the last night. You're going to spend it with me. You'll do what I want. And she succumbs to him and basically services him one last time. And that's that. So it's the next morning. And you have to understand, Sharky's been watching all of this and he's disgusted by it. And he feels for her, but he's not liking the situation. Now it's cut to the next morning and Sharky is up and awake and smoking cigarettes and looking through his binocs, looking into her apartment from across the way, but he can't really see her because the shades are drawn, the curtains are drawn, and these drapes, if you will, are somewhat sheer, so he can see that there is, she's behind them, and she's moving back and forth. Little does he know that in the same building where he's staked out, and a few doors down on the same floor, is Bill Score, the hitman. Bill Scarelli. This is the same hitman, Henry Silva, we saw kill a prostitute earlier in this film, and now he's got eyes on Domino, too. He's basically staking her out from another room, just a few doors down from Sharky. So bad guy Bill, in his room, starts cutting up some, we don't know, coke? Heroin? We don't know. With a razor blade? It's drugs. He snorts it on the windowsill, and then he pops some pills, which we then learn afterward is synthetic heroin. This guy's all gooped up on gop. And he opens a briefcase filled with guns and bullets and shotgun shells. Cut to, we see this bad Bill already in the elevator of Domino's building. He's gone across the way. He's going up to see Domino, and he gets to her floor. He hits the emergency shutoff in the elevator and goes out into the hallway and to her door, ringing her doorbell. Now, Sharky, looking through his binoculars into her apartment, can't really see what's going on, but he can hear the doorbell on the wiretap from his side and wonders who that could be. And then he sees Domino run to the door. Cut back to Domino's apartment, and outside the door, we see Bill waiting until he could see the shadow of her underneath the door, so he knows she's standing there. And Bill Score swings out in front of the door with his sawed-off shotgun, And before she has a chance to open it, he yells really loud. He just goes, ah, and fires a single blast through the door. Across the way, Sharky hears this and rushes across the street. But of course, he's too late. And he goes up to Domino's apartment, sees the hole in the door, looks through it, and sees Domino lying dead in her apartment with her face blown off and blood spatter all over the wall. It's extremely gruesome and upsetting. This whole sequence, the stakeout, my favorite part of the stakeout is the romantic portion when we're watching Sharky fall in love with Domino, watching her every move, kind of having a conversation with her all along the way, kind of matching her movements and her patterns, drinking, eating, sleeping, all of that. And then this death sequence is absolutely brutal. And Henry Silva is just this maniac. He says a few words here or there in English and in Spanish or Italian. I'm not sure. Either way, he's creepy as all hell. And that moment when he steps in front of Domino's door with the sawed-off shotgun and just yells like a maniac and blows her away, very shocking and gruesome and very loud. So that got me. It's like, okay, this is a bad dude. And our main love interest just got blown away. So that surprised me. I was like, okay, here we go. I'm in. I'm involved. I'm into this. What's going to happen next? So love those scenes.
Yeah, I did like the hit. I thought it was very smart because we are conditioned to think doorbell rings. We have to wait for the person to open and then person gets blown away. But I always thought to myself, well, why did you do that? You know, the person comes to the door, shoot through the door. So the fact that Billy Score actually does this, nice job. And yes, the scream I certainly was not expecting. So I'm like, oh, that's really loud and giving yourself away. But I think that way apartment's set up anyway, there's no neighbors, so they're not going to hear anything. And then he just peeks in and you just see Tiffany, that we find out his face is blown off. So he thinks he did what he has to do. And then we have an intense chase with Sharky trying to get Billy before he escapes. As an audience, you totally get fooled thinking that it was Domino.
Yeah, that's what's going to lead into my next favorite scene, which is pretty brief. But Henry Silver, like, he doesn't have to say a damn thing. But when he's in, he's just, they got that look on his face and he looks like an evil bastard. And he just yells, he just screams. You're like, oh my God, this guy's a wacko. This guy's a total whack job. And he's totally hopped up, of course. He's all jacked up on Mountain Dew, Chip. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't give a damn who could probably hear him. I mean, he's trying to be somewhat clandestine. He goes down the stairwell. That's kind of a fun moment, too, after he's trying to get out of the, when he's trying to get out of the building. I think you kind of alluded to that with Sharky. There's a little cat and mouse thing in the stairwell. But, okay, this movie's going for it. I like it.
Yep.
All right, that's okay. I'm going to go right into this, what I was calling the bait and switch.
Yes.
And the big reveal here. You know, I was saying earlier that I like when a movie sets a mood. It sets the right mood for this genre. And this genre is neo-noir, folks. This is a noir. So I keep saying gripping and gritty cop drama, but it is a neo-noir. And at this point in the movie, Sharky and his machine have put together some evidence and figured out that the hitter, the hitman, is named Bill Carlos Scarelli, or Score, and he's been part of a long-running sex trafficking prostitution ring with his brother Albert. Meanwhile, Sharky now decides to go back to Domino's apartment to see if he can find any other clues they may have missed or that have been left behind after her brutal murder. This is what I mean by setting the mood, is like he's walking around the apartment. It actually cuts to this scene with him staring at a portrait of Domino while a sultry version of My Funny Valentine is playing in the background on the record player. And he is looking over the scene of the crime where there's still blood and broken glass for some reason. And then we hear the elevator bell from the lobby outside. And all of a sudden, a woman's voice begins to sing along with and over the song My Funny Valentine. And Sharky, while he's walking around the apartment, turns to see a woman enter with two bags of groceries in her arms, and the groceries are blocking her face. We don't know who it is. And then she walks into the kitchen, puts the bags down, turns around to see Sharky staring at her in amazement because it's Domino. She's alive. Dun, dun, dun. She looks at Sharky and says, what the hell are you doing here? And basically he replies, I could ask you the same question. And she's walking around at calling for Tiffany, and she turns off the music and asks Sharky where Tiffany might be. And she says, if you don't get out of here, I'm going to have to call the police. And he says, I am the police. And he walks up to her. This is a great moment, showing her a badge. And he says, Sharky, Vice. And he says, a woman was killed here yesterday. We thought it was you. And of course, we figure out that the woman that was killed was most likely Tiffany, her best friend. It was not Domino. Domino is alive. And there's a nice moment here, too, because then all of a sudden, her phone rings. And Sharky picks up the phone. And it's a call from Nosh. And Nosh is across the way in the stakeout building. And he tells Sharky that all of the tapes, all the recordings are gone. All the surveillance from the department that was back at the department and that was in this room, it's all gone. Someone stole it. Meaning, obviously, someone on the inside doesn't want them to pursue this case any further. Meanwhile, we see baddie Bill Score shows up again with his sawed-off shotgun at the stakeout building. And we know that he's about to go after Nosh. But Nosh tells Sharky that he's made copies of the tapes, and Sharky tells him to go home and lay low. And Nosh finally says, Shark, who's on our side? It's great delivery. Just another shout out to Richard Libertine. He's great. And then Sharky tells Domino they got to get out of there because eventually Scarelli will be coming after her, that he wants her dead. And she says, I am dead. And he looks at the bloody wall and says, no, that's dead. This is all great stuff. I bring up this scene because I bought it, Bill Bant. I just bought it hook, line, and sinker. I took the whole bait and swallowed it. I thought she was dead. I thought Domino was dead. So this reveal was a surprise to me. I loved it. I liked the mood of this scene, all of it, when Sharky goes into the apartment to see if anything was left over, any clues that they missed. And I thought it was a dream sequence at first. I thought Sharky was having like this fantasy sequence of her coming home to him in her apartment, as if after watching her so closely for so long, he was having like this lucid fantasy while standing there in her apartment. But it turned out she was real. She's alive. And I love this reveal. So there you go.
Yeah, because I think the movie would still work if, unfortunately, Domino dies at that point. And because Sharky has this connection from across the buildings, that then it would almost kind of become a revenge flick at that point on. So, yeah, I could see why you would get, like I said, I don't remember when I watched it the first time if I fell for it myself, but watching this time, I knew that she was still alive.
Mm-hmm.
But the good thing is, yeah, it could work either way if she lived or died in that moment. So it does make a very effective scene.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you got?
For one of my favorite scene or moment, and we kind of teased it at the very beginning with Jason's quote before we started the episode, and it's a trope that we've seen many times in some of our films, and two that we've already covered, Beverly Hills Cop and Sudden Impact, has a certain scene like that, and that's when Sharky decides to confront Albert slash Victor to let him know that he's on to him and he's going to take him down. So this is after Sharky takes Domino to his house that he was raised in, and his parents passed away and he bought the house, and now he's there fixing it. And that's where he's keeping Domino safe and not letting anyone know whatsoever that Domino is still alive, because at this point he fears there is a mole in the police department. And if they find out that Domino's alive, then Victor Albert's going to know that Domino's alive and, of course, send Billy after her to have her killed. So we have a shot where we see Sharky entering. It's like a function, but we find out it's a restaurant, and he shows his badge to the maitre d', and the maitre d' calls someone over, and Sharky shows his badge again, whispers a conversation, and maitre d' or the manager takes Sharky into the restaurant and then points over to Victor slash Albert's table. And we have Sharky. He heads over to the table. Victor is surrounded by his women. They're probably the rest of the Thousand and Night call girls. And Sharky's just going to lay down his cards and say, I've got you by the balls. I'm going to take you down. And Victor, of course, as our bad guy, always has to be super overconfident and says, you got nothing on me. Unfortunately, the only person that can help you take me down is dead. And Sharky says, no, you are wrong. Domino is still alive. And at that moment, you see Victor Albert do a total 180 in his face, because at that point he knows he is in deep shit. And if Domino does say something, he can bring down everything that Victor Albert has been working on to take over Atlanta. And that's when Sharky has that great quote. I'm just going to say it again because I love it so much. And I think that's
Please
what
do.
Sells it over the top compared to our other usually police officer confronts baddie scene. And he goes, "I'm going to pull the chain on you, pal. And you want to know why? Because you're fucking up my city. Because you're walking all over people like you own them. And you know the worst part? You're from out of state." And then he turns around and walks away. You're just like, yes. Like I said, it's a trope. We see it tons of times. But for some reason in this movie, I really liked it.
You got to love it because he's got the trump card, right? He's got the ace up his sleeve. He knows that Domino's alive. And then he reveals that to Victor slash Albert slash Bill's brother slash Kingpin of Atlanta. And Victor's a good, you know, he's just literally mustache twirling pretty almost. But he has the mustache that he could twirl if he wanted to.
Yes.
So he thinks he's got the upper hand. And we said this a million times already on our podcast. We'd like to see our bad guy get his comeuppance. And although he doesn't get arrested in the scene, definitely Sharky gets one up on him. So fun to watch. Some great dialogue, too. That's fun.
Yeah, it is. So that takes me to my final moment. And it's actually the closing shot of the film, my closing shot over the credits. So just to take it to the ending, Albert Victor knows he's in deep shit. He's going to get out of town. He's having a conversation with his brother, Billy Score, saying, "I'm getting out of town. And when I get settled, I'll bring you in." Billy doesn't want to hear that. He wants to leave now because he doesn't want to get caught. So they have a little argument and Billy ends up killing his brother. So after that happens, we have Sharky's machine. They converge onto the building, thinking that they're going to arrest Albert and Victor and find him dead and realize Billy did it. So now they're trying to capture Billy. They have the big shootout. We unfortunately lose Pop in the scene. Arch gets shot multiple times. You don't know if he's going to live or not. And then Billy himself gets shot multiple times. And Billy, I think at this point, pretty much knows he's going to die, but he wants to die on his own terms. And he confronts Sharky and he says that he's not going to take him in. He's going out his way. And before Billy can commit suicide, Sharky shoots him a couple times. And that's when he falls through the window to his death out the plaza. And that's where we have our super stunt by Dar Robinson, 220 feet drop. Unfortunately, we only see the first maybe 50 feet and then they cut away to a crappy dummy.
Mm-hmm.
Like right after the fall happens, we don't even see Billy hit the ground. It does a hard cut to the outside of Sharky's house that he's renovating. And he's out there with Domino and he's pushing her on a tire swing. And we have our closing song and we have our credits and we have our helicopter shot. It literally pulls from the backyard of Sharky's house, goes up, turns around. We see downtown Atlanta again. It makes its way to downtown to the plaza. And as the credits end, the very last frame of this helicopter shot is of the plaza with that window that Billy Score jumps out of. It's all boarded up at this point and then cut to black. I thought it was a pretty good shot.
I love it, Bill Bant. And I had mentioned this again when we were offline because you told me about that. And I was like, oh, I turn the movie off before it got to that.
Well, the song that they play over it, yeah, it's not that good.
Yeah,
so well, I can understand turning it off.
I have an averse reaction to that kind of music, but the credits are rolling and the camera, and I'm like, oh, okay, this is it. It's over. It's just aerial shot of Atlanta, whatever, but there can't be anything else. But there's a little period on it at the end that I missed, and now I got to go back and watch it. Thankfully, I do have the DVD, so I can check it out. I'm glad you called that out and that you broke down a little bit of that last sequence, because that's important. It's a big action sequence at the end of this movie and well-known. A couple of moments I want to shout out real quick is one during the relationship sequence, the bonding between Sharky and Domino at his childhood home that he's renovating. There's an intimate moment that happens by the window when I'm watching the kids play outside their school next door. And I like this moment where Sharky actually doesn't kiss her. I like that choice. I thought that was smart.
I did too.
They didn't rush into them making love all of a sudden, where it's like, we know it'll eventually happen, but it was just too quick. It was too soon to have happened in that moment. So I like that. And then, yeah, that ending, man, that action sequence and Silva, good old Henry Silva, is just fucking out of his mind. I love the fact that he's so jacked up on his narcotics that he takes several bullets. They keep calling him a yes. ghost because he keeps getting hit and then disappearing, getting shot and taking off. At the end, he stands, he like gives himself up. He just stands in front of the window. And it's a great backlit shot. You can barely make out his face when he's standing because the sun's shining through the window behind him. And he's standing up like on a ledge in front of the window and says, I'm not going to die. I don't think I'm going to die, at least not by you. And he puts the gun to his head, like you said. And then Sharky says, die, and shoots him and blows him out the window. Just wanted to call that out. Yeah.
Yeah, there's another thing I want to point out that I really liked about the action sequences with Burt Reynolds is especially the opening and that closing. Like, he is soaked in sweat.
Yes.
You can really feel what you can literally see what he is going through. You know, he's not all perfectly pampered and stuff. And, you know, one of the things that he did talk about, if you do go back, because I know you mentioned the Carson interviews, and it's kind of mm-hmm. funny because I did watch one of them that did talk about this movie. And he talks about how he did not wear a hairpiece. It was like, I went with my natural look in this film. And I like it. I like the way he looks in this movie. I think he looks copish to me. And it really yeah. works. And it shows that, you know, he's not perfectly manicured. He's got all the, you know, makeup's all done right. No, he's like a sweaty, nervous wreck because there's a mad killer in the loose. And he's already seen one person, his partner is dead. Another one's could be dead at any second. And he might be next. He's gunning for him.
Yeah, you know, so much of this is we talk about neo-noir in setting the stage, setting the mood, setting it everything. And so much of it depends on authenticity, you know? So the sweat that's pouring on his face, you know, three quarters of this film is great. I think the street scenes, you know, of Atlanta, it's not pristine. It's not clean. There's trash on the ground. You can feel it. You can sense it. The weather, whether it's hot or cold, it works. I think they did a good job of paying attention to those details. And it's interesting. You brought up his hairpiece, because I actually thought he looked really good in this, but there are some times where I'm like, oh, is his hair painted on? It's so flat. But you did the research. You saw the interview, and I guess he did not have the toupee on for this.
Yeah, I mean, they might have enhanced it with a little color, but yeah, he's
it's not overly obvious. He still looks good. It's not, it's just, he's working with what he's got in this one.
Yeah, there you go. All right, time to move on to Swiss cheese and complaints department. And why do we call it Swiss cheese?
Because although this movie is delicious, it does have sawed-off shotgun holes.
Yes, and if it does not have those sawed-off shotgun holes, we just file a complaint with the complaint department. Jason, what do you have for Swiss cheese over complaints?
For my first complaint, again, often my complaints are questions for you, Bill Bant. And my first complaint I'm just calling names and numbers. So in the opening of the film, when Sharky gets bumped down to Vice Squad, down the cesspool in the basement.
Yes.
Well, we know that they're basically busting prostitutes, and they've gone to a rally for the soon-to-be governor, or running for governor candidate, Hotchkins. And they bring in a couple of prostitutes. One of them is named Mabel, and they throw her in the cage. And then she calls out a pimp who happens to be there, who's some sort of highfalutin pimp. He's like a big pimp around town. I guess I'm trying to put this together, but they pull off of him either his wallet and a list of names. I think they got it from him. On this pad of paper, there's a list of seven names, and each name has seven letters. It's either six or seven names. Regardless, I got confused here, but
it's seven.
So it's seven names. They each have seven letters. And then immediately Sharky decides to decode this. He immediately goes, I'm going to figure out something. And he sits down with the pad of paper with the names, and he assigns a number to each letter in each name. So I'm going, okay, I follow that.
I wasn't sure what he was trying to do. And I was like, wow, that's a stretch that you figured that out that fast.
Well, that, yeah, it's a little quick. They move through that portion really quickly, and I was like, I had to watch it a couple times to be like, what just happened here? And then
I thought it was smart.
Oh, it's smart. And then later on, they're like, well, we got to get wiretaps for all seven of them. And then it gets confusing because they cut to a scene where they're coming down from the homicide department where they're trying to get wiretaps, but they gave them all the wiretaps except for one, Domino's, which was curious. And that's why Sharky goes to his friend Nosh, who was in the personnel department. Nosh is the one that can do the workaround and get the wiretap set up on Domino's phone line. But when they're coming down the stairs discussing it, saying we can't, they won't give us the wiretap on Domino. What is it? Sharky says something like, or Lieutenant Frisco says, well, you got five.
Right. And he says, I need six.
Sharky goes, I need six. And I'm like, but there's seven. There were seven.
I had to go back and watch. Number seven is the blind call girl with green eyes that gets killed in the beginning.
Right.
She was technically seven. So they find out she's dead. So we only need six.
Okay. Yeah.
And then they give them five.
Yeah. I'm glad you figured all this out.
I had to watch it again because I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, okay, wait, they just said seven before. Why are we down to five and need six?
Yeah.
And someone is a throwaway line when they're, it's almost like when they're turning down that they say, oh, yeah, the one's dead.
Okay.
I was like, oh, yes.
There are some real throwaway lines in this that,
yes,
happen. And you're like, okay, I needed this to be clearer because the same thing happens when they get the fingerprints of bad Billy Scarelli. And they say, right, oh, yeah, here's a picture of him with his brother, Albert. And then Albert turns out to be Victor. But that's never very clear. And the fact that they're brothers, and then it's not clear enough.
Yeah, that I didn't realize until the end that they were brothers. Yeah. And I still don't understand why the guy who had the Brillo hair, chest hair, got killed.
Yeah.
I'm not sure who he was.
That's another throwaway line. It's like he was like a CIA agent or something.
Yeah, I thought
like
they mentioned
government
it
agent or something
in the car. Yeah, but I wasn't 100% sure who he was. And then even why did the pimp leave the stuff? Because they do mention that pimp runs off quickly. Spencer, he left all his stuff there. Well, why? Or why did the police even have possession? Oh, was it because they brought him in with the girls?
It's not clear. I assumed that those prostitutes, that he was their pimp, and that's why he showed up at the precinct.
Right.
Maybe to bail them out.
Right.
They end up taking his wallet and his pad of paper with the list of prostitutes on it, and then leaves. He leaves without his wallet?
Right.
None of that made sense to me.
Yeah, so it's like they booked him and he was free to go, but he didn't take his property? I don't know.
So if you're confused, listeners, listening to us discuss this, that's basically how we felt.
It probably makes sense in the book.
We do some of this work so you don't have to. All right, what do you have for your initial complaint or hole?
I don't think I really have any holes. So my first complaint is when we see Smiley pull up on the drug deal, mm-hmm, and our drug dealer, Highball Mary, shoots the windshield, and then Sharky goes to check on Smiley, and it looks like Highball shot out four windshields because he's got about four windshields of glass all over him. That's a lot of glass for a little hole. I mean, it's a big hole.
Right.
A little too much for my taste.
Yeah. I love, again, these little things you pick up on, but you're absolutely right. I totally agree. I saw it too. And it was in the back of my mind, but I wouldn't have called it out. I'm glad you did.
Yeah. And then how did the drug dealer even miss Sharky? Like, we know the gum jams or he doesn't have bullets. And then he pulls out his other gun. But right, Sharky is 6-7 feet away.
Yeah.
I know guns aren't the most accurate, but he's at that range, close, he should have a big hole in his back.
Right.
End of movie.
Credits roll. Here's a problem I had. I do like Charles Durning, but I did not like his character that much in this. He portrays Lieutenant Frisco, and he's really uneven throughout this. It's almost like he's bipolar. I don't know what his deal is in this movie, but I think he's supposed to provide some comic relief, and sometimes he's supposed to be that hard-ass police chief, like filling out that trope we often see in these cop movies. But it doesn't always work for me. He's really chewing the scenery and overacting in a lot of the scenes. I like the idea of having levity with his character because he's like always complaining about how the bad guys have it better than him. The right, cops are on the wrong side because this pimp's got $700 in his wallet and he's only got $11 in his wallet. Or a $1,000 a night prostitute has a much, much more lavish apartment than he does. It's just uneven, his character. And at times just plain goofy. There's even a purposefully choreographed scene when Sharky's machine, meaning Sharky and his pals, his fellow detectives are all meeting at a baseball field to discuss the evidence they've gathered. They're all sitting in a row, and it turns into a shtick. They're all going over the evidence, and they're passing the evidence down the line, and Lieutenant Frisco is like behind, and he's trying to catch up. Hey, wait, hold on, hold up. And he keeps going down the line, trying to see what they're looking at, and it's very shticky.
Yeah, I didn't get that scene at all.
I was like, what are we trying to do? And it's just, they're playing it for laughs and it doesn't work. And I'm like, this is not the genre. You're out of the genre now. It's that push-pull. You're taking me out of this movie now.
Yeah. I was why are you at a baseball stadium?
Exactly. Thank you, Bill Bant. That's exactly. I was like, they shouldn't be there. They should be in some safe house, covert, under an overpass, hidden, gritty area, right? Because this is a neo-noir. They shouldn't be in out in the sunlit, well-lit baseball field doing the scene here. So it didn't make any sense to me. My general complaint was with Lieutenant Frisco's character.
Listening to you talk about Frisco almost makes me think, were we supposed to believe that maybe he was the dirty cop that was leaking information? Was that what they were supposed to do?
You could go down that rabbit hole. I always assumed it. I mean, the obvious answer is Detective Smiley. Smiley's the rat. Like, he's the one that...
But maybe they were in cahoots just because he's always upset about, like, Domino has this lavish apartment. Here's our pimp with $700 in his pocket. And
in that scene when he's complaining about the expensive apartment, we're on the wrong side, guys. He's saying that they need to report it to homicide. And the rest of them are like, no, we can't.
Yeah, he wants it as easy as... easy can be. That's why he's down there. He doesn't want to get his hands dirty.
So you could make an argument that he could have possibly been a dirty cop.
I didn't think about it until you just started talking about him.
Yeah.
I did not have that mindset watching the movie, but I don't know. Maybe they were trying to trick us and I missed that one. Yeah. Another complaint. Sorry. It's about one of the scenes you talked about. We find out that Domino's alive. She didn't seem so upset that Tiffany was killed. I mean, I liked how they set it up when she just walked through the door. And then she had the bags covering, so she misses the door frame. Because, again, there's a throwaway line during the stakeout where she yells at Tiffany. She's like, what, do you live in a farm? Because I guess Tiffany has a habit of leaving the front door open. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, okay, that makes... Because the first time I was like, wouldn't she know something's wrong right away because the door's wide open? But Tiffany does that, so she walks, yeah, you know, she walks gotcha. Through with the bags. But then when Sharky tells her that Tiffany's possibly dead, and we see all that blood is still there, not clean. I was like, it's like, you don't seem pretty upset.
Yeah, well, she's crying at the end of the scene. I mean, she's in tears. She's visibly upset, but not in the way I understand what you're saying. Like, she should be overly distraught that her best friend was brutally murdered.
Yeah, I think I would be in shock as soon as I saw the blood.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some subtle reactions in it. Sure, you could make an argument Sharky should be more shocked at seeing her walk in the door too.
That's true.
He plays it pretty cool. That's why I really thought it was a dream sequence, because he was just kind of staring at her, going like he was in a trance. Good call. Speaking of other character issues, look, I like Bernie Casey a lot, and his character of Arch, he's got some weird lines in this that I couldn't make heads or tails of. Again, with I'm just trying to land on what this character is supposed to be, where he's coming from. There's a moment when he's interrogating the drug pusher who's named Kitten.
Mm-hmm.
And he walks into the room where Kitten is. And there's another dude and this woman sitting there. I think Kitten tells him to get out. And he goes, yeah, get out of here, bitch. Arch, take it easy, pal. What? It just felt like really out of character. There's a moment in that final action sequence when they're chasing Henry Silva. And they're in like a, I don't know, offshoot somewhere in that abandoned portion of the building. And Sharky tells Papa to stay by the door because it's the only way in or out. And then when Henry Silva eludes them and goes back, we hear the gunshots and he kills Papa. Arch gets mad at Sharky. He's like, oh, you told him this was the only way in or out. You know, you fucked up. Basically, you got him killed. I'm like, Arch, what are you talking about? Why are you yelling at Sharky, blaming Sharky for Papa's death in this moment? It was just really weird. And then when Arch himself gets shot up and he's sitting there bleeding to death, it seems. We don't really know what happens to him. But there's supposed to be like this weird comedic moment where keeps calling Sharky back. He just says, Sharky, I need to tell you something. Sharky, I need to tell you something. Sharky's like, what? and it repeats over and over again. And it just was really out of place. It felt like a parody movie, like it was something out of Loaded Weapon, not out of an actual drama. They were, again, it seemed like a moment where they were playing it for comic relief, playing for laughs, and it felt out of place. I'm just like, Arch was weird in this to me. I didn't get his character.
I liked Arch, but what you're saying does make sense to me.
Yeah.
I wouldn't believe he would call that woman a bitch unless he's just trying to look tough and in front of Kitten.
Like he's playing a role in that moment. He's a tough guy. He's going to shake down the drug dealer.
All right, I'll give that one a pass. Yeah, the second one with the door. Yeah, you can't be mad because it's the only way you can communicate with Papa that just stay by the door. Because if Papa comes in the room, Score could get around him and easily escape. He's a cop.
Yes.
That's his job.
Right.
So, yeah, the thing at the end, too, with him getting shot and keep calling Sharky over. I'm 50-50 on that one because part of me was like, dude, you got to let him go to get the killer. But at the same time, you're dying. You know, it's one of those, I don't want to die alone. He would know better where he's at.
I can buy it. It felt like more of a moment that you'd see either in Lethal Weapon 2 between Riggs and Murtaugh or
I agree with that
Loaded
too.
Weapon. Like if it was a buddy cop movie, not a neo-noir cop drama.
Right. And then, but you know, back of my mind was like, where the hell's everybody else?
Yeah. So that's where I get some of the characters and some of the writing. Tonally, it was uneven for me. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
What else do you have for complaints?
Oh, the dance class scene.
Okay.
That's poor direction, poor editing. That scene could totally go. I felt bad for Rachel Ward in that. It's almost like borderline embarrassing. It's like, if she can't dance, then do a headshot and then get a double to do some of the other moves. But everything's like tight on her face and all we see her do is keep putting her hands up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then two or three shots of her ass. And that's about it. The whole movie, she keeps saying she's a dancer. And then we see a dance class, but we don't see really any dancing.
Right.
I could have went in and did that scene and be like, damn, Bill, I didn't know you were such an amazing dancer.
Let's shoot that. I want to shoot that. We'll just have you like bouncing up and down, but we'll just shoot you from the waist.
We'll
up
do a shot for shot. Yeah.
Lifting your arms up and down and to the sides, and it'll make it look like you're a professional dancer or that you're really in class, really studying hard. That would be awesome. And then I'll be standing outside looking through the door, just looking on fondly, looking at you.
There you go. Yeah. Okay. You can play Sharky. I'll play Domino.
I'm going to save my other complaints for some additional thoughts. But the final complaint for me has to be the stunt. It's not the stunt itself, of course. The stunt itself is brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
All credit to Stuntman. He's amazing. I mean, it's truly a fantastic stunt. And that shot when he comes bursting out the window looks awesome.
Yes.
And he is falling. Like, it looks fantastic. And they cut away from one of the greatest stunts of all time to an overly exaggerated, obvious, are you fucking kidding me, dummy? Are you joking? It's a dummy. Why would you do that? Let's say even if they had that shot of Darth doing the stunt coming out the window and they didn't get the whole thing and it just cut like halfway down, like it does in the movie, to nothing, to the next scene, that would have been fine. Because it was that cool. Just for those 2 seconds, right, you see him fall out the window, I would have bought it. I get it. He fell out the window. But don't cut to a dummy falling another 300 feet or whatever. Come on.
Yeah, and I think what even made it worse is that documentary I was watching about the making of the movie is they show him do the jump out the window and he hits the bag and he gets up and he goes to, he's like, do you want me to do it again? So they did multiple takes. So why do you not have him falling farther? Or I was thinking if this was like a Jackie Chan movie, they'd show him bust out of that window like 5 or 6 times in a row, kind of.
Yeah, right.
Which annoys me, but I almost wanted to see it multiple times.
Mm-hmm. Because it was cool.
Yeah, it was cool. Yeah, because you wanted to feel like how far is he really falling? And you don't get that sense. And I almost feel like, wow, what a wasted stunt.
And that's why I'm going to make the comparison to the high-rise fall at the end of Die Hard. Because I was, I almost thought about which, you know, to ask which one is better. But it has to be Die Hard because you see the stuntman actually fall.
Right.
It's from a much further distance, but they kept the shot in.
Right. Difficulty-wise, it's Sharky's machine.
Right.
The overall result is Die Hard, hands down.
Right. The way it was cut, some fancy photography, it was well-edited. And then you have the far away shot of the stuntman falling.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the whole thing. But this closer shot of Sharky's machine is really cool.
Yeah. All right, my last complaint, and then we'll move on.
Yeah.
So we have the scene of Sharky got captured. He's on a boat. They're cutting off his fingers to find out where Domino is. And it's Smiley and the two henchmen. And they cut off two of Sharky's fingers. And then Smiley asks the henchmen to leave.
Totally.
Why?
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
It was an idiotic moment. I totally agree. I was like, oh, this is such a trope in these movies where the bad guy does something just completely moronic. I mean, that's just a stupid decision.
Right.
You would never ask your henchmen. Why would you ask your henchmen to leave? You're just asking.
Right. You got him where you want him.
You're asking for the good guy to get one over on you in this moment. You're just asking for it. You're right.
Didn't like that.
It's the common trope of a bad guy monologuing, right? At the end of a movie.
Yes.
Where you're like, oh, idiot, you have a gun to the good guy's face. Just shoot him. Why are you monologuing? Because you know it's giving the good guy time to get
work
one up
out
on
how it's going
to
escape. Yep. Right. Moving on to, hey, it's that actor. In this segment, we spotlight a character actor you have seen in many other films, an actor making their big screen debut, or an actor that makes an uncredited cameo. It's, hey, it's that actor. Who do we choose this week? And man, there is so many to choose from.
Yeah, there are. And I was going back and forth between a couple of these. But this week, our, hey, it's that actor, Joseph Mascalo, who is Detective Joe or JoJo Tips. Lots of Joes. He is Sharky's partner, or at least was Sharky's partner, I believe, or at least he shared a desk with Sharky in the beginning of this movie in the narcotics department. This is Joseph Mascalo we're highlighting here, or spotlighting here. His acting career goes all the way back to the late 50s, but he then played the role of Jack Lander in 266 episodes of the 1961 TV series From These Roots. He then continues on to do numerous, numerous one-and-done episodes of television series for the entirety of his career. Shows like Car 54, Where Are You?, or All in the Family, then to Kojak, to The Rockford Files, The Incredible Hulk, The Trial of the Incredible Hulk. He was on the show Hill Street Blues, Hunter, etc., and etc. He also played the role of Peterson in Jaws 2 in 1978. Had to put that in there for Bill Bant,
yes.
Big Jaws fan. But where Joseph Mascalo, or Mascalo, made his bones was in soap operas. And that's why I'm going to get to this, why I chose him for our Hey, It's That Actor. Notably, Joseph was on 49 episodes of General Hospital as Nicholas Van Buren in 1989. You're going to have to ask your wife if she's familiar with that character, Bill Bant. He was also the character Massimo Moroni the Fourth in 476 episodes of The Bold and Beautiful from 2001 to 2006. But most famously, he played Stefano D'Amera and also Dr. Tufano in 1,847 episodes of Days of Our Lives. During periodic stretches from 1982 to 2017, his final appearance on Days of Our Lives aired actually 2 months after his death in 2016. So that's why I chose him, is because I grew up on Days of Our Lives. My mom was an avid viewer of Days of Our Lives, and Stefano D'Amera was a classic character. He was the classic bad guy, could never die, could never die. He just kept coming back, and he kept showing up on that show. Love me some Joseph Mascalo as Stefano D'Amera. He did end up winning 3 Soap Opera Digest Awards, and a little bit of trivia. According to Soap Opera Digest, he had an open-ended contract on Days of Our Lives, which allowed him to play villainous Stefano D'Amera whenever he felt like resuming the role, and whenever the writers came up with a good storyline. This allowed the character to be killed off more times than anyone can count, coming back in one memorable sequence through a bargain with Satan himself. Oh, you gotta love soap operas. So that's our Hey, It's That Actor. This week, Joseph Mascalo as Detective Joe JoJo Tips. But before we conclude the segment, Bill Bant mentioned her earlier. If you caught it, he said, the girl with green eyes. So I gotta give a shout out to Susie Pye, who also plays blind prostitute named Sai Quan. I saw her as Bill did and was like, oh my God, that's the girl from Big Trouble in Little China.
Hell yeah.
And sure enough, it is Mao Yin. She's very, very striking, beautiful woman.
Yes, she is. I thought for sure when you were talking about Joseph that maybe the two of you shared a scene in General Hospital.
Oh my God, how cool.
That's what I thought. That's what I thought you were going with that. I was like, no way, that's awesome.
Yep, he was on before my time.
But there you go. I mean, 6 degrees.
Hey.
You're a degree off Burt Reynolds. That's pretty cool.
For our listeners out there, I was very fortunate. I guess we did talk about this, didn't we?
That's okay. During if we got our, some Heather, new listeners.
Our Heathers episode, was that right?
Was that the one?
I think so. John Ingle, my guy, John Ingle, had a featured supporting role in Heathers, and he was the patriarch on General Hospital, and he got me an extra gig. I was the bartender at the Metro Court Lounge for a brief period, for about a year and a half on and off in the mid-2000s. So there's my connection to Joseph Mascalo.
There you go. Okay, it's time for some facts and trivia. What are some facts and trivia we have about Sharky's Machine?
Yeah. Fashion model Rachel Ward was cast in the female lead after being spotted in Time magazine as the face of the 80s. She was cast 6 days before filming. Here's a quote from Burt Reynolds. That was like starting King Kong without the gorilla. I kept saying, she'll turn up. She'll turn up. Then I saw Time magazine. I wanted an actress who could speak Italian and French. And since she was English, I thought she might have the kind of foreign attitude that I was seeking. When she came in my office, I heard her voice deep like Bacall's, and I thought she would be ideal. But Catherine Deneuve once told me how a beautiful woman will appear on the screen. You must look at her through the camera and see if it has a love affair with her. I picked up a viewfinder and looked at Rachel. I damn near fell over.
Damn.
Yeah, Burt Reynolds, fond of Rachel Ward. I understand why.
As I mentioned in the beginning of our episode, this movie is based on the novel by William Deal. And Mr. Deal does make a cameo in the movie. And he is the pimp Percy Sinclair that we've mentioned throughout. So that is William Deal, author of Sharky's Machine.
The movie's opening credits sequence features the hit song Street Life, we've mentioned a couple times, which had originally been sung by the Crusaders with singer Randy Crawford. The recording used in this movie was a newly orchestrated cover by Doc Severinsen, which was also the version used by Quentin Tarantino for the later movie Jackie Brown in 1997.
John Borman, who directed Burt Reynolds in Deliverance, was originally attached to direct, but dropped out due to post-production work on Excalibur, and he said to Burt that he should probably direct this film.
According to Turner Classic Movies, good old TCM, the resurrection of Domino and her first angry words with cop Sharky are a direct quote from Laura, the 1944 film. That's Laura's initial confrontation between Gene Tierney and Dana Andrews from that movie.
This was one of 14 projects that Burt Reynolds and Charles Durning worked on throughout their career. Some other notable projects that you would see Burt Reynolds and Charles Durning on were The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, Starting Over, Stick, and the TV series Evening Shade.
Oh, cool.
They were very good friends.
Yeah, that's cool. I ran across a fun little bit of trivia regarding Charles Durning saying that this was the thinnest he ever was or ever would be in a movie. I was like, that's nice.
Who's measuring that?
Like, I think that's, yeah, a matter of perspective. I don't know how factual that was, but I'm like, that's real nice. My last bit of trivia is regarding that final stunt. Just mentioning that the stunt was performed from Atlanta's Hyatt Regency Hotel, which was doubling for the Westin Peachtree Plaza Hotel.
Okay, time for box office. So Sharky's Machine was released on December 18th, 1981 in 1,388 theaters on an estimated budget of $17.5 million. It grossed $32.9 million domestically. It debuted number two at the box office behind, sorry to tell you this, Jason, but behind Neighbors,
what?
Which we have covered on this show.
Oh my God, that's not possible. I don't believe that for a moment.
And would stay in the top 10 for another 4 weeks. Sharky's Machine was the 19th highest grossing movie of 1981 here in the U.S., just behind Endless Love by under $16,000. Moving on to reviews, when growing up in the 80s, we would watch sneak previews with Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert to hear their reviews and watch clips of upcoming movies. Their review of Sharky's Machine was not available online. You cannot find that episode. And that episode also included the aforementioned Neighbors. Mm-hmm. But I was able to find both Siskel and Ebert's reviews for the paper. So Roger Ebert gave the film 3 out of 4 stars, writing that Sharky's Machine contains all the ingredients of a tough, violent, cynical, big city cop movie. But what makes it intriguing is the way that Burt Reynolds plays against those conventions. The result of his ambition and restraint is a movie much more interesting than most cop thrillers. Gene Siskel gave the film 2.5 stars out of 4, saying, obviously, Reynolds decided to hedge his bets in the film and play some of it for laughs. That's too bad, because although Sharky's Machine is miles ahead of such recent Reynolds trash as Smokey and the Bandit 2 and The Cannonball Run, what Reynolds could use most in his career is a solid dramatic role in which he didn't leer at the audience. So Rotten Tomatoes gives it a tomato meter score of 83% with an audience score of 62%, and it has an IMDb rating of 6.3, which brings us to additional thoughts and questions. Do we have any additional thoughts and questions about Sharky's Machine?
Yes, we do, Bill Ben. I said I'd save a couple of things for this segment, and we talk about Henry Silva as an excellent bad guy in 80s movies before and after, and he's great in this, so ominous and menacing. And unfortunately, there is this weird scene at the end. It doesn't take away from his performance or the movie really that much. It's just an awkward scene between himself and whom is supposed to be his brother, the main villain in this, Victor. And it's just not clarified enough in the movie that they are brothers, and then we have this what's supposed to be like this emotional scene between the two of them. It's like a heated discussion that turns into a bit of an explosion. And I was just thinking, as much as I liked Henry Silva in this, I don't think he should have ever spoken a word. Just his look was enough, maybe just a few words here and there, if at all. But as soon as he started talking in that scene at the end, I was like, oh, this doesn't work for me now. They kind of weakened him a little bit, and I did not like that. So my additional thought here is that I would have preferred that Billy Scarelli, the hitman, should have never spoken, just a silent villain. Let Victor do the talking. And that led into my other thought here and question for you, Bill Bant, is did you feel that was a worthy death for the main villain in this, whom is Victor? Or do you think maybe Billy Scarelli is the actual main villain? Because after this awkward sequence, this relationship scene between Billy and his brother Albert, otherwise known as Victor, Billy ends up killing him out of frustration and in a moment of despair and anger and whatever. I didn't like that as much. I would have preferred to see Victor die in a different way, maybe at the hands of Sharky or the cops or whomever, but I didn't know how you felt about Victor's death here at the end of this movie.
I agree with you. I was kind of disappointed that that's how Victor dies. I've always wanted to write a paper about this. The difference between like a supervillain and a villain, and usually a villain goes down because someone within his party ends up betraying him and takes him down. Whereas compared to a supervillain, it's always our hero that's able to save. Like you think about James Bond movies or supervillain, it's always James Bond that kind of saves the day. But then if you think of your villains, you always think of like New Jack City, where it's always someone that wants to take over, and then that's the end of the demise of your villain. And this is what kind of happens here. We have our villain and someone who's his brother ends up killing him. But what made it disappointing is up until that point, I had no idea that that was his brother. So I'm already dealing with the shock of finding out that these two are brothers.
Right.
And I get it. He's so hopped up on drugs that he's not thinking straight and he feels like he's being abandoned. But your answer is to then kill your brother.
Yeah.
So it is kind of disappointing. I think I would rather have had Sharky's Machine come in and still maybe even kill Victor first. And you can still have the shootout
right
with Billy. You can still end that way. But yeah, I was kind of disappointed.
It would have had maybe more impact, like you said, if we had more relationship development between Billy and Victor throughout the film. We've got our main villain and his hitman, and then we discover they're brothers, and that they have a history together, and that Billy's always looked up to his brother. And then in this final moment, his brother is abandoning him, then it maybe would have been more heartfelt. Or, oh, it's like, oh, wow. Yeah, okay. This is a tough scene. But yeah, it wasn't satisfying.
Agreed.
I was thinking Bill Bant, I could definitely see a reboot of this. I could see for sure.
Thinking the same thing.
I wouldn't mind it. Like, I would like it. I welcome. This is one of those few that I actually would welcome. If it was done right, really make it a neo-noir film. Don't make it glossy. I don't want to see big-time A-listers in these roles. I want to see some unknowns, some really good actors, and make it tough.
Right. I almost didn't want to bring it up because everyone, oh God, no, you want to remake this. But yes, I thought the same thing. And the second thing was, why did they not do a sequel?
Mm-hmm.
I liked the shark character enough that I would like to see him in another film.
Yeah, like Dirty Harry.
Yep.
And of course, in the trivia, then we did come across this, that a remake of the movie was announced in April 2006. But show business trade paper Variety reported that it was not expected that the remake would be set in Atlanta. Phil Jeannot was slated to direct, with Steven Levinson and Mark Wahlberg acting as executive producers, with the latter possibly starring. And see, this is where I'm going. Thank God they didn't do it.
Right.
Phil Jeannot, I love, because State of Grace is one of my all-time favorite cult classic under the radar movies of all time in the world of the universe. But Mark Wahlberg, I actually am a fan of his, but I don't want him in as Sharky.
No, I agree. Yeah, I don't know who I'd want in that role.
I want more of an edge. You know who I'd like a lot is Oscar Isaac, like somebody like that, maybe.
Yeah, that might work.
That just came off the top of my head.
Yeah, because I was trying to think about their ages, and I think Reynolds is around 45.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie Casey was the youngest, I think, at 42, 43.
Oh, wow.
That group, yeah.
That's funny. They all were older.
I know. I was like, what? How old are these guys?
Yeah.
But yeah, I would like to see them remake it.
Yeah.
I'm going to go see if I can find the book, too, just to see what they changed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Ready to move on to our rating?
Let's do it.
All right. On a scale of 1 to 5 wiretaps, what do you give Sharky's Machine?
I'm giving it 3.5. That's 3.5 wiretaps. As I said in the beginning, I really like this movie. The tone is uneven at times. I'm not crazy about a couple of the characters. It can be confusing at times. But once I knew the players, I was in for the ride. Take out some of the comic relief and some of the 70s tunes. I mean, I like Doc Severinsen's actual score. Give me more of that. And this is then completely awesome. I like the style. I like the action. There's some decent twists and turns. Bert is a great leading man. And importantly, the bad guys are pretty solid. The bad guys are actually bad. So yeah, Victor was no bueno. And Henry Silva is a maniac. So we got Rachel Ward as well, making her first major film appearance. And she's stunning. And the movie's a rough and tumble. Grimy cop movie. It's right up my alley. I'm happy to have finally seen this in its entirety. So I enjoyed it. What's your conclusion, Bill Bant?
Yeah, I'm giving this 3 wiretaps. I liked the character of Sharky, and yeah. I liked the vice department, and I thought Rachel Ward did a really good job. But yeah, I did have to watch this movie a second time to totally understand the plot, because there is a lot of throwaway lines that are kind of important to the story.
Totally.
I think you said it best. There is a push and pull. There's some scenes that really get you into it, and then a scene kind of takes you out of it. And a scene is like, why are they doing this? But overall, I would certainly recommend it. It's another side of Burt Reynolds we don't get to see. We didn't get to see much of.
Yeah.
You know, I always go to Deliverance first. But outside of that, I'm always thinking of like the romantic comedy stuff or his goofy, playful roles. So this is the side of him I'd like seeing. If you have not seen it, I would certainly recommend it.
Good call. I concur.
Okay, so I think that about wraps it up for this week's episode. As always, thank you so much for listening. Please take the time to follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Give us a review and rate us. If you want to learn more about our show, you can visit us at all80smoviespodcast.com. For our next episode, we will be discussing Diner, starring Steve Guttenberg, Mickey Rourke, Daniel Stern, and Kevin Bacon. We hope you can join us. Have an excellent week, everyone.
You know, Frisco, when we used to flush the toilet upstairs, we always wondered where it came to.
Thanks for staying up with us. Good night, world.